All right, good afternoon, everybody. It is 12:41 on Tuesday, March 2nd, and we are going to finish up the alcohol chapter right now. So let's go ahead and start a screen share. I think I figured out what I've been doing that is not working when I go to screen share. And that is, I try to hit the buttons too fast before my iPad establishes connection with the computer. And if I hit screen share and move into it and it hasn't fully connected, then it doesn't connect properly. And you guys don't see what I see. Even though it looks like it's working on my end, it's not working on your end. So I think I've got that solved, which is great, because I'll stop making that mistake. Okay. We left off talking about oxidations, or at least I previewed that we were going to talk about oxidations. So today's topic is all about oxidation. And in the oxidation, for the different types of alcohols, whether we have primary, secondary, or tertiary, there's different types of oxidation patterns that we see for these alcohols. So when we look at a primary, without showing you any oxidation processes or requirements, primaries can be oxidized into an aldehyde. Remember, oxidation is the loss of hydrogen or the gain of oxygen. So by those means, we are both gaining in oxygen in that we have a double bond, and we have lost two hydrogens. So the loss of hydrogen also counts as an oxidation. Aldehydes can be further oxidized to carboxylic acids. And it turns out that actually aldehydes are more reactive than alcohols towards oxidation. So it's very difficult to stop at the aldehyde in the intermediate in this one. Secondary alcohols, when you oxidize them, oxidize to their ketone form. And then if you try to oxidize them further, there's no reaction. They're at their oxidizable limit in terms of going to the ketone. And tertiary alcohols, try as though we might, cannot be oxidized. And when looking at alcohols and figuring out what can be oxidized, what cannot, it really is down to the hydrogens that are geminal to the hydroxyl group, and that there is no hydrogen on the tertiary. These hydrogens, the way in which the molecule is oxidized is that it is the removal of these hydrogens and the pushing of those electrons into a double bond that generates the carbonyl. And so with no hydrogen to pull, there's no way to oxidize a tertiary alcohol. So that's basically the way that we look at them. And now the devil is in the details. So there are a number of different oxidizing agents, many actually. We're going to look at just a few of those oxidizing agents. And we're going to look at basically two classes. We're going to look at those that are based on chromium. And then we'll look at one alternative to chromium in terms of an oxidizing agent. So the chromium-based ones start off with chromic acid. This is Jones oxidation. Oftentimes just referred to as Jones or Jones reagent. This is a chromium oxide with acid. We'll say H2SO4 because that's generally how it's done. And this is done in acetone as the solvent generally. And this is one way of doing it. The other way is written out with sodium dichromate, Na2CR2O7, sodium dichromate, H2SO4, and water. Both of these are Jones reagents. They're just achieved differently. Both of them produce in solution chromic acid. And it is the chromic acid which is the oxidizing agent. And in the chromic acid, the chromium is in a +6 oxidation state. It's called hexavalent chromium. And that hexavalent chromium in the +6 oxidation state is an extremely strong carcinogen. It's a known carcinogen. It's not my favorite reagent to work with because of its carcinogenicity. That just means that it is a known agent that causes cancer. And so we're just very careful when we work with chromic acid. Chromic acid starts off in that +6 state, and it's orange in color in the +6 state. And as the oxidation goes forward, I'll show you the mechanism of how this reagent works. So let's start off with just ethanol. And I'll write it out as the reaction with the chromium oxide, H2SO4, and acetone. The chromic acid protonates the alcohol. So we have that formation of the chromic acid. This is a strong acid that serves to protonate the alcohol in its first step. The protonation of the alcohol then winds up doing, depending upon the substrate, either an SN1 or an SN2. This one will go for an SN2 since it's primary. So this guy knocks out the water as a leaving group. So the chromium now becomes attached to the carbon through its oxygen. There are the two hydrogens that are present that are geminal to the oxygen. The water molecule or some other base in solution serves as the base, pulling the proton, pushing the electrons in to make a double bond, and the chromium acts as the leaving group. When that acts as a leaving group, the organic molecule is oxidized. So we get the aldehyde in this case. Plus we wind up getting chromium, which has now got a lone pair of electrons on it. The chromium has been reduced. And we end up with H3O+ as well. So that's the process. And as that process goes forward, the chromium then goes into a +3 oxidation state. And in the +3 oxidation state, it's green. In the +6, it's orange. And so you can tell how the oxidation progresses or when the oxidation is over by the change in color of the chromium reagent and how the chromium actually goes to a green color. So the problem with this, though, is that while we have that mechanism of oxidation, when we look at the reactivity or the availability of these molecules to be oxidized, what we find is that if we look at the aldehyde is more reactive than the alcohol. This is more reactive towards oxidation. Which means that every little bit of aldehyde that you create immediately gets oxidized with the chromic acid, and there's no way to stop it. So the reaction proceeds in a way that if we have ethanol and we oxidize it using CrO3, H2SO4, and water or acetone, then the reaction goes through the aldehyde, but can't be stopped at the aldehyde. The reaction progresses all the way to the carboxylic acid. And there's no way to stop at the aldehyde. That second oxidation mechanism, by the way, if we wanted to see the second oxidation mechanism, it looks something like this. The aldehyde in the acidic medium becomes protonated. Once protonated, it is subject to nucleophilic attack by the chromic acid. That nucleophilic attack adds in the chromium. And then that's what's going on. I was gonna say I lost my hydrogen. I couldn't figure out how I was gonna pull my hydrogen in order to get this to work because there was no hydrogen there. Okay, so from here, the base, be it a water molecule or whatever it is, winds up pulling the proton. Electrons push in, push out onto the chromium, and we end up with the carboxylic acid. And the chromium has been reduced again. There we go. And so we can see the formation of that carboxylic acid in that way. And aldehydes are so reactive. They have such a large partial positive. And when they're protonated, they're so easy to do nucleophilic attack on that they're just much more reactive than the alcohol in terms of this oxidation scheme. And in fact, aldehydes are frequently oxidized just by air. Just by sitting in open air, that they can be oxidized easily. They don't even need a strong oxidizing reagent like this. So the question then becomes, how do we stop at the aldehyde? And if you look at this reaction mechanism, what you see is that the key here is the first step is the protonation, and that acid is the first key in terms of an aldehyde being attacked and being oxidized. So if you could get rid of the acid, then you could prevent this oxidation component. And that's what they realized. And that was the next reagent that we want to show. So the next reagent, let's put here, if we could reduce the acidity of the oxidizing agent, we could stop at the aldehyde. And so that's where the next two reagents come from. The first one is called Cori reagent, or Cori's reagent. In this reagent, what they do is they take an amine base and they react it with the CrO3 and with HCl. So acid is a part of this, but it gets bound up with the amine base and it makes a reagent where we make what's called the pyridinium ion. And as part of this, we make chromium O3Cl-. This reagent is called pyridinium chlorochromate. And we usually pull out the PCC, and we abbreviate it as PCC, pyridinium chlorochromate. It's, the pyridinium has a positive charge. So there's our charge balance. It's a complex ion. But not acidic. And the chloride acts as a leaving group within the reagent. So that that reagent, I believe, looks like a chromium. We have the two double bonds, the O- and the chloride, which is on the chromium. And the pyridinium is just the counter ion. So we have the nucleophilicity that we need of the oxygen in order to do the reaction that we want. But we don't have the acidity of the reagent because now the proton is bound up in the pyridinium ion and it's not acidic in any way. So that's how the reagent functions. And now what PCC allows us to do is it allows us to be able to take an alcohol, primary alcohol, and be able to oxidize it using PCC and stop at the aldehyde. Whereas if we were to do this with Jones, we would go all the way to the carboxylic acid. So the two reagents give us some selectivity in terms of what sort of product we want to produce. And there's one more reagent in this family that's related to Cori's reagent that is also non-acidic. And so we like to show both of these. And the other reagent is called Cornforth reagent. There it is. In this reagent, they take and they react the dichromate with HCl. And so I believe that this one takes pyridine plus CR207. That needs to be a sodium, Na2, CO207 plus HCl. And they make pyridinium dichromate. And there are two of these, and there is the CR207 2 minus. And this is called pyridinium dichromate. And that is PDC. Also non-acidic. And functions exactly like PCC. And it can be used, yes, JC, for secondary alcohols. I'm going to show that in just a second. These can work on secondary alcohols as well. So what we find is that with a primary alcohol, let's take a reagent where we can have all three. And we'll look at a primary alcohol. And we'll look at all three reactions with the primary alcohol. So the first reaction would be Jones. Second reaction would be PCC. Third reaction, PDC. Jones would oxidize all the way to the carboxylic acid for that primary. The PCC and the PDC will oxidize and stop at the aldehyde. If we were to take and look at a secondary alcohol, and we look at the three reactions, all three produce the same product. Jones, PCC, and PDC. All three of them produce the same ketone. So why having so many different oxidizing agents? Because they can do different jobs. Because PCC and PDC are selective and will selectively oxidize only to the aldehydes, and yet they will also oxidize a secondary to a ketone. It means that we can do certain reactions where there is a primary and a secondary alcohol both in the same molecule, and we want to oxidize the primary and stop it at the aldehyde and the secondary to the ketone. I can do that with PCC or PDC. Jones would take the secondary to the ketone, but would take the primary to the carboxylic acid. And so it gives me options. It gives me different abilities to do different things. That's why. The problem with all of these, as I see it, is that all of these use hexavalent chromium, which is carcinogenic. And so sometimes it's nice to find a greener alternative to these, a reaction that that gives a selectivity but also doesn't use chromium. So that's the next reagent that I would like to show. So this next one, I'll do it on a new page, it's called SWERN. The SWERN oxidation is a very mild oxidation. It is a beautiful oxidation in its mechanism. So this is part of why I like to show it. It uses a reagent that is called oxalyl chloride. It's a diacid chloride. The diacid chloride is extremely reactive can cause chemical burns, a little bit hard to use, but it's not carcinogenic in any way. It uses a solvent, DMSO, dimethyl sulfoxide, and it uses triethylamine. And it's usually done really cold. It's usually done at like minus 78 degrees Celsius. So it's done at extremely cold temperatures. And maybe what I should do too is show, let's do it this way. Let's move this secondary down and let's do a primary up here as well. The primary will stop at the aldehyde while the secondary will go to the ketone. And so it works on both primary and secondary. It just does different jobs. And the mechanism is what's really sweet. So let's take a look at how this mechanism works. The first thing that winds up happening is the oxalyl chloride reacts with the DMSO. And so there's a whole set of reactions that happen I think we should understand what DMSO is before we do this. Dimethyl sulfoxide, DMSO, it has two methyl groups, a lone pair on the sulfur, and a carbonyl. DMSO has an extremely strong dipole moment. If you look at the sulfur is using 2, 4, 6, 8, 10. This is a 10 electron exception for sulfur. The 10 electron exception for sulfur also has a resonance contributor. That resonance contributor is one in which the sulfur has the octet, 8 electrons. But in order to have the octet, it also has to have the dipole. It also has to have the minus and the positive. This means that DMSO is actually a fairly strong nucleophile with this strong dipole moment and the partial negative that's on the oxygen. So from this resonance contributor, we can attack the carbonyl, which is electron deficient, and it opens up into a tetrahedral intermediate. That tetrahedral intermediate collapses. And as it collapses, it pushes out the chloride. The chloride then, because the sulfur is positive and can accept more electrons. The sulfur acts as an electrophile, the chloride, a nucleophile, and the chlorine attacks the sulfur, making a sulfur bond. The sulfur lets go of the oxygen. This is almost like an SN2 reaction. That pushes in and pushes electrons up onto the carbonyl and breaks the carbonyl. So you get sort of like a cascade of things that wind up happening here. So what I've got at that point is now a sulfur, which is bound to a chlorine and has the lone pair and the positive charge. So that's one part that's been produced. The other part that's been produced is that guy that is broken off. And that piece actually breaks down and pushes the electrons into here. The electrons, I want to make sure that I push in the right way. Electrons push in, these guys push out. They push into here and out to here. And this whole thing here breaks down into CO2. It breaks down into carbon monoxide, CO. And it breaks down into chloride ion. So that whole thing breaks down into those guys. It is this piece here that is then the active reagent, and the alcohol, which I didn't show. Let's do a primary alcohol so we can see how it stops. The alcohol comes in and attacks the sulfur, pushing out the chloride. There's a deprotonation step. And then finally, an oxidation step. And in this step, a base pulls the proton. Electrons go in, and electrons go to the sulfur. That makes our aldehyde, dimethyl sulfide, We've also made an equivalent of HCl. We've made CO2. We've made carbon monoxide. And we've got a chloride ion in addition to that, and an equivalent of acid that we pulled out. And so basically what happens is this guy is a gas and leaves the reaction vessel. These two here, carbon dioxide and carbon monoxide, these guys are each gases and they leave the reaction vessel. And that triethylamine that I showed, the triethylamine takes these guys here that are the acids and makes ET3NH with the positive charge and the chloride ion. And that's a salt that precipitates as a solid. And so everything here goes either out as a gas or precipitates as a solid. And you're left with this that you isolate out of solution without anything else in the mechanism, which is really cool. And so it's super easy to isolate out your oxidized material because everything else in this reaction vessel either precipitates out or goes off as a gas, which is just super pretty. So that's the Schwerin oxidation. And the Schwerin oxidation is complementary to the other chromium-based ones. The best thing about this one is that there is no chromium agent that is carcinogenic. So this is a more green alternative to the oxidations, the Schwerin oxidation. So we have three. We have Jones, which can be written two different ways, CrO3, H2SO4, acetone, or the sodium dichromate, H2SO4 and water, We have PCC, which is the pyridinium chlorochromate. Oftentimes you will see these by their abbreviations rather than by the actual formula for the reagent. So we look for the names more than we look for the actual reagents. CrO3Cl. We have PDC, pyridinium chlorochromate. This has two equivalents of the pyridinium ion, and the Cr2O7 2 minus. And then the last one is the SWERN. The SWERN is the only one where you tend to see the formula more than you see the name. So on Jones, I would say it's about 50-50 whether you will see the reagent or see the name. PCC, PDC, you will only see the name. You very rarely see the reagent written. And on the SWERN, you almost always see the formula and not the name. And then this one, the reagent is more common. So just to give you an idea how that breaks down. Are there strategic advantages or disadvantages? It depends on other functional groups. JC, that's a great question. Let's say that you have a, okay. Question. What are the advantages or disadvantages? Of the reagents. Let's say that you have a reaction that you want to do where you have an alcohol that you have protected with a methoxymethyl ester. And then you have another one here that is a primary alcohol that we would like to oxidize. And your goal is to oxidize it and you'd like to oxidize it to the aldehyde. That's what you'd like to be able to do. And what reagent do I want to choose to do that? In understanding this, you need to understand the nature of the MOM group and how the MOM group is removed. If you remember what the MOM groups looks like, the methoxymethyl ether group, it has the two oxygens connected to the same carbon, and this is the acetal type. It's broken by taking water and acid, and can remove that in order to make the alcohol. And we also get an equivalent of formaldehyde that comes off and methanol that comes off. So those components there, this guy becomes the formaldehyde, and then the rest of this piece of the reagent becomes the methanol. And so that's where things break down. But what's critical here is that it's broken by acid. If you go back and you look at Jones reagent includes strong acid, H2SO4. The H2SO4 would remove the MOM protecting group and would not allow you to accomplish this. And so if you took this reagent, and you treated it, I guess I need to put this on the other side. And you treated it with Jones. What you would get is you would get that guy. If you took that and treated it with the Swern oxidation, PCC, PDC, or Swern, because of their lack of acid, they would not touch this protecting group. The protecting group would stay intact, and you would be able to stop at the aldehyde. And so you just have to be careful with Jones, that because Jones includes strong acid, that any acid-sensitive groups that are in your molecule could be reacted under Jones conditions. And so, yes, there are strategic advantages and disadvantages that we need to be careful of, the type of group that we have attached. And that can include double bonds or triple bonds that may also be sensitive to acid and protonation, that when we're doing acid type, strong acid reactions, that those functional groups could be touched as well. So what we tend to do is we tend to use or lean towards those that are not acidic to be able to do these types of jobs, unless the rest of the molecule has nothing else to worry about in it. Or we change the protecting group. So if you change the protecting group, for instance, we could use a protecting group that is removed by TBAF. So we could do OTMS. That's only removed with TBAF. Now I can do Jones. Now I could go ahead and I could oxidize this and I could get the carboxylic acid, and this would stay as the TMS protected because that's only removed with TBAF. That's only removed with the tetrabutyl ammonium fluoride. So yes, we can see differences in the reactivity depending upon the different types of functional groups that are in the molecule. Does that help a little bit, JC? That's not a full answer, because a full answer would take hours and hours of going through and showing many, many, many different examples of which we could do. But the point is to watch how your protecting groups are removed, and to stay away from protecting groups that are removed by acid if you plan on using a strong acid reagent. That's sort of the main idea there.
Do we need to worry about anything sterically or no?
No, not with these. These reactions aren't really influenced by sterics. They are influenced by primary, secondary, tertiary nature of alcohols, but it's not because of the sterics. So when we look at primary, versus secondary versus tertiary, it immediately looks like we're dealing with a steric issue, but it's not. It's the issue of where the hydrogens are, and that these hydrogens are required for the oxidation mechanism. And that's what allows them to actually be oxidized. And the tertiary having no hydrogen attached that is geminal to the oxygen cannot be oxidized. So it's not sterics. It's about the proton that can be pulled. So no steric issues. That's JE geminal protons. So that's what we're looking at. Okay, I had one more sort of oxidation mechanism to show you that I like to show in this regard because, you know, we talk about oxidations and we talk about reductions and we show all of these crazy reagents that are super strong reagents. And yet, how does oxidation and reduction occur in a biological system? So in a biological system, when the cell needs to oxidize or reduce molecules, which we do all the time within biological systems, they can't operate with chromium or with PCC or PDC or Jones or Swern or any of those things. How do the biological systems do it? So I like to take a minute just to show you this because we don't make it all the way to the biological chapters most of the time within the curriculum, but it's nice to take a minute and to show some of the chemistry that we would have seen in those chapters in context of the reactions that we're studying. So humor me for a second. I'm going to draw a really big molecule. You don't need to keep up. It's not something that I generally throw into a test or something. But I like to show the structure of these guys. So this reagent is NADH. NADH is nicotine adenine dinucleotide, and it has a structure that is like an amino acid, not an amino acid, a nucleic acid. So the sugar here is ribose. This is the part where I always get stuck and make it too tight in here for me to be able to fit in the piece that I need. I'm gonna move this down and relink with a long bond to be able to draw my amine base here. Okay, that's the whole thing. And that's NADH. And the important part of the molecule, the functional part of the molecule, is this guy up here. And that's it. All the rest of this is all for solubility. And so what we do is we function just on this piece of the molecule here. And we take that guy and we abbreviate all of this this way. call this group just R. And we deal with that as our NADH. So let's take that guy and show how this functions. So what it does is, as a reducing agent, if I have a ketone that I would like to reduce, what happens is the lone pair here pushes in, let me use a red pen just to make it clear where the electrons are going. The electrons push in, the electrons push over, and a hydrogen transfers as a hydride. And so the bond breaks and the hydrogen takes its electrons with it, pushing electrons up onto the oxygen. So there's one hydrogen left, but now that hydrogen has been transferred as an R group, or excuse me, as a hydride, and made a new bond here. What I'm leaving off or forgetting is the rest of this piece that I wanted to include in there. Okay, and that's the reduction. This was NADH. This is NAD. And the reason that it does this is because the molecule that is here is transitioning from aliphatic to aromatic. Those are the terms that we use. Aliphatic means something that is not aromatic. So aliphatic meaning that it doesn't have that special stability that aromaticity has. Aromaticity, we know, and we haven't studied it yet, but we know that when we get these three alternating double bonds in a six-membered ring system, that that's a really stable configuration, and that is something that's aromatic. And yet it has the positive charge. It doesn't want the positive charge, but it wants to be aromatic. And so it very easily goes back and forth between these two states, the aliphatic state and the aromatic state. And it's balanced in tune to be able to do both of these jobs, which means that NAD, and actually I should put the plus on here because it's NAD plus. What NAD plus can do, which is really cool, is that we can take NAD plus and it can act as an oxidizing agent. So we have the one hydrogen here. If we have an alcohol that has a proton on it, some base can pull that proton. The electrons can kick in. This can accept the hydride. And in accepting the hydride, electrons shift over and shift onto the nitrogen. And we have reduction. This one should have been, oxidation. That's what I messed up on. And so what happens here is we wind up getting the oxidized species. And we go back to NADH. And this can go back and forth and do this job many, many times.
Jason, out of curiosity, what biological systems are using?
So this is used in the Krebs cycle. It's used in the citric acid cycle. This is the oxidizing and the reducing agent that helps to break down glucose. And you'll see it written out in the Krebs cycle. And they never show you the structure and they never show you how it works. They always just write it as NAD and NADH or NAD plus and NADH. and they never tell you anything more. They just say, whoa, poof, it does it, magic. But it's actually just a very elegant little mechanism of accepting a hydride or delivering a hydride and converting back and forth between this aromatic and aliphatic state, because the molecule is so tuned to wanting to be in both states and the energy levels are so close that it's able to convert back and forth and just be able to do these two different jobs. So it's a very elegant, beautiful little oxidation and reduction mechanism that's very simplistic just in the transfer of a hydride. And we don't think of organic molecules very often as being able to transfer a hydride. I mean, we've never seen that before. An H minus coming off as a leaving group? What? Doesn't happen. Actually, it does in water, in your body all the time. It's actually kind of cool. So I like to show that. And in terms of the citric acid cycle, I think it looks something like this. So you have the citric acid cycle, which comes around. You have NAD plus that comes into the citric acid cycle and out of this makes NADH. The NADH then is converted back into NAD plus through ADP being converted into ATP. And so it's part of the glucose is broken down by NAD plus, which then gets converted into NADH. And the NADH then reacts with an adenosine diphosphate. And that adenosine diphosphate is converted into an adenosine triphosphate. And the NADH is recycled back into NAD to go back and do the job again. And so this is where your energy production comes from, is actually the ATP output out of the citric acid cycle. So that's part of where that's coming from, which is super cool. Okay, that concludes chapter 13 and takes us into chapter 14, which is almost entirely review. This is ethers and epoxides. And in terms of nomenclature, the nomenclature system, usually what we do with ethers is use a common nomenclature system. So if we look at ethers, the system usually is ethyl, methyl, ether. We name each substituent as a substituent with a YL ending and then tag the ether name onto it. So if we have something like this, it would be tertiary butyl methyl ether. Or what we're used to using in the lab would be diethyl ether. We could do it systematically too. So we could have ethers named in a more systematic nomenclature way. For instance, this one is 1-methoxy, 3-methyl butane. So the way that that one was named is that we named it 1, 2, 3, and 4, there's your 3-methyl. And then this piece was named as a methoxy. So that's your methoxy substituent located on carbon number 1. So that's a systematic sort of nomenclature. Out of the ethers, there are some common solvents that you should be aware of and should be able to recognize. Your common solvents are ET2O, diethyl ether. THF, tetrahydrofuran. Tetrahydrofuran is named from furan. Furan has four hydrogens on it. But tetrahydro has the additional four hydrogens, thus the tetra. So that's where its name comes from. And then dioxane is the last one that is less common. It's a six-membered ring system with two oxygens in the ring system. So that's dioxane. These are all ether solvents and they're used for common aprotic polar solvents. Aprotic polar so they're all good aprotic polar solvents. This is a cool little thing. Let's say that what I wanted to do was I wanted to do an SN2 reaction with potassium fluoride. And I was trying to do this in water. And I was looking to do an SN2 reaction. This gives no reaction. Potassium fluoride, despite its solubility in water, the fluoride ion is so highly solvated that its nucleophilicity is shut down. We basically think of this as like a caged nucleophile. And it's so tightly caged that it just can't react. So its nucleophilicity is shut down in water and it can't react. And you think, oh, okay, well, I'll get away from the water. So maybe what I do is I change this and I try to run this with potassium fluoride and benzene. A lot less water-like, but you still get no reaction. And you get no reaction because, potassium fluoride is ionic. And it's not soluble in benzene. So if you can't run it in water and you can't run it in benzene, how can you do this reaction? The way that you're able to do it is to use potassium fluoride in benzene with 18 crown 6 ether. And then it goes super fast. So what is 18 crown 6 and how does this work? 18 crown 6 is a way of referring to crown ethers. This is a crown ether, and this is 18 crown 6. The way that we refer to it is that the number of oxygens, there are six oxygens, That's the six. And then 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11, 12, 13, 14, 15, 16, 17, 18. That's the 18 all the way around the ring. So when we count all the way around the ring, it's 18 atoms around the ring. Oh, yes, Kelly. Sorry, everybody. Apologize. I'm on a roll. I'll back it up. Put the whole image on there. I'll slow down. I'll drink some tea. All right, so what the crown ether does is the crown ether binds to cations and specifically potassium. So I don't know that I would redraw this for all of you. I would cartoon this, but essentially what it does is the potassium fits right in the middle. And each of the oxygens donate their electrons to the potassium and stabilize it and hold it. And it is just set up just the perfect size to be able to hold that potassium. And so it supports the potassium. Now, the potassium doesn't come all by itself. The potassium comes with the fluoride ion, and the fluoride ion is outside the cage. So what happens is by solvating the potassium, now it makes the potassium look organic, not ionic. And now this is soluble in benzene, and it brings the fluoride ion into benzene with it. And it makes the fluoride then a really strong nucleophile that can do the SN2 reaction. And so this is a trick: by grabbing the cation and bringing the cation in, you also bring its friend. This is being invited to the party by having a good friend. What is the thing that they put on the wedding invitation? Plus guest. So you get to bring your guest with you. The different crown ethers have different abilities to solvate different ions. So if we look at, for instance, a 12 crown 4.
Jason?
Yeah.
So crown ethers are, non-polar because of their symmetry, but are polar because of the amount of oxygens to carbon ratio. Or like, that's why they're able to solvate an ionic.
They're solvating by sequestering. It's almost as if you were to take, I don't know if you've ever heard of capturing within a buckyball another element within a buckyball. You're adding like a stoichiometric equivalent of this, so that the crown ether, when it binds the cation, the interaction outside the cation is all nonpolar. And what's inside the cation is polar ionic, or what's inside the crown ether is polar ionic. And so it is its ability to donate the electrons from the oxygens to the cation that make it a complex all on its own, and it brings the anion with it. I think that's the best way that I can describe that.
So that's why from a solid, the ionic piece would break apart.
It's because what it does to the solid is it grabs the cation from the solid, and yet by electrostatic attraction, the ionic bond is too strong. The anion and the cation can't exist singularly on their own. And so the anion has to go wherever the cation goes. So even though the cation, like this one, lithium, is what fits inside this guy. The lithium would bring whatever anion, if it were a fluoride or a chloride or a bromide, if this were lithium bromide, it would bring the bromide with it. And the bromide would be outside. And yet like dissolves like. So these oxygens are acting as ligands. That's the other word that we use with these metals, is that it's acting like a ligand for the lithium. It solubilizes the lithium within the compound itself. And then this complex is now nonpolar in its entirety. And this complex is then soluble within a nonpolar solvent. That's basically what we're saying here. And so what we see is that 12 crown 4, 15 crown 5, and 18 crown 6 are the most common. And the 12 crown 4 is sized specifically for lithium. The 15 crown 5 is sodium. And the 18 crown 6, potassium. So we use those different crown ethers for different metals to do different jobs.
And it's just based off of their size?
That's all it is. It's just about their size.
You probably already said this, but the 15, 12, and 8, it's multiplying the 4, 5, and 6 by 3, but...
So your 6, mm-hmm. That's the oxygen number. So the last number is how many oxygens there are in the system. The 18 is the total number of atoms in the system.
Oh, okay. Thanks.
So when we come back here, we've got 12 atoms total. 4 of those are oxygens. 15 atoms total, 5 are oxygens. That's the way that's working. Okay.
I have kind of a weird question.
Go for it.
Would this do anything with like sodium hydride? Would that?
Theoretically, I've never seen it used with sodium hydride, but if we were to try to bring sodium hydride and to do a reduction in benzene, and we wanted to use sodium hydride, we should be able to do it with 15 crown 5. And be able to do a deprotonation. Maybe we wanted to do a reduction. Maybe what we wanted to do was to take some aldehyde and reduce it to some alcohol. And we could get the sodium hydride we needed to do it in benzene for some reason. Or maybe this was a bigger molecule that was only soluble in benzene. And because the molecule was only soluble in benzene and we wanted to use sodium hydride to try to affect that, then that's one way that we might be able to do that. It just gives us options for being able to get ionic things soluble into an organic solvent. Because we can't do everything in water. And in fact, most things we don't want to do in water. And so how do we get those ionic reagents into a solution like this? The other option that we haven't talked about is that if we don't want to use water, we use an ionic liquid. And there are many ionic liquids now that have been developed. And that's a more recent thing. Within the last 20 years, they started developing ionic liquids where most things, when we say ionic, those ionic things are solids. But if you make an ionic thing big enough and the right flexibility, you can make an ionic liquid. And all of a sudden now you have a solution where you can use ionic reagents in the ionic liquid to do organic reactions. And that's a really cool topic that we don't get a chance to cover either. But ionic liquids are super, super cool. Let me ask you a question. Change topics for a second. I only have a minute, so I just want to ask you a question. I want to see how you guys answer this. I have two ways that I could put an ether together. I want to make this ether. And so this is a reaction that I want to make this ether. And A, I could envision putting this together by using tertiobutyl bromide and methanol, or even sodium methoxide. Or B, I could envision taking sodium tert-butoxide or potassium tert-butoxide. Maybe we can even do the potassium here. And reacting it with methyl bromide. And I could think about both of these reactions and which one of these reactions would be the better reaction. Could you tell me? Which reaction here is more likely to produce the product? Does anybody want to take a shot at it?
I think B.
BB? Why BB? You always have to be prepared when you answer. It's like, he's going to ask me why. He's going to ask me why. I shouldn't say anything because he's going to ask me why.
I mean, it's a large base, and then you have a primary leaving group, and it's just something that we've seen a bunch of times that works. That's a bad answer.
It's an SN2 reaction. What is SN2 reactions governed by?
Sterics.
Sterics. And so you keyed in on it. The key in was that this was a primary substrate and that you were reacting at a primary substrate. And that if you tried to do this reaction over here, that you're counting on trying to knock this out. You're trying to do an SN2, but it's not going to go SN2. It's going to go E2. And you're going to wind up getting this guy because this was at a tertiary substrate and you're trying to do an SN2 at a tertiary substrate. That's never going to work. So what you do is when you look at this and we say, all right, I could break here or I could break here. If I break here, this leads to reaction A. If I break here, this leads to reaction B. This is inherently what is called a Williamson ether synthesis. And a Williamson ether synthesis is where we take an alcohol, we react it with one sodium hydride to deprotonate, and then two, an alkyl halide. And we make the ether. For every ether, there are two ways to tear it apart and two possible reactions to put it back together. The reaction that you put it back together is the one that has the less sterics and is the more optimal SN2 reaction that hopefully has a primary side to it. And I say this as review, you've never seen it written as Williamson ether, you've never thought about it, but inherently everything that you learned in the SN2, SN1, E1, E2 chapter comes into play in the Williamson ether synthesis. And there's nothing new here to learn, other than you already knew how to do it. So in the ether chapter, in learning to make ethers, we do it by SN2 and we choose the route that is a more successful SN2. And Pokey, you were also thinking B, B, because the leaving group on A is tertiary. That's exactly, you got it. That is exactly right. Okay. And so again, I could ask you, what if you wanted to make this material . How would you envision tearing this apart? Well, I've got two modes. I could tear apart here. We could say this is A, or I could tear it apart here. These would be my disconnects. And if I go by A, disconnecting it in A would take and give me some bromide plus the alkoxide. And if I break it into B, I go the B route, then I would be working with this alkoxide and that leaving group. Which one of these is the better route, A or B? Get your chemical lenses on. Get the right glasses on. Look at the alkyl halide. Decide which alkyl halide is more appropriate for the SN2. A, because less sterically hindered. And that's the correct answer. So you see how you guys already know how to do this in terms of Williamson. Okay, I'm going to cut it there. I think in our next lecture, what we'll do on Thursday, I will do the last little bit of this chapter, and then we'll do sort of a review and wrap up, bring it all together. And then we'll set a date for that exam and talk about how that's going to work and give you some review stuff to be able to go through and work on and some more problems and things. All right, quiz 4 is up and live. I forgot to tell everybody. Is the quiz all the way through today's material? No, quiz was before today's material. So you didn't need today's material to do quiz 4. So quiz 4 is up, it's live. And I published it now, which I didn't do before because I was lame and that's the way it goes. That publish button, sometimes you hit and you publish the module and you always forget that not everything in the module publishes, that you have to publish everything individually. And that's what I did. So I published the module, but not the whole thing. So that quiz is up there, but you've got until Friday to do it, I think is when I put the due date on that. So you've got some time to be able to work on that. And it's an easier quiz. It's really, except for maybe the synthesis. I think I upped the synthesis challenge a little bit. Part A is easier. Part B is a little more. You have to think about it a little bit. That's good. You need some challenges. All right. Go enjoy your day. I'll stay on the line if anybody has any questions, and I'll see the afternoon lab in the afternoon. Okay. Thanks, guys.